You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 11, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mother Jones writer Ari Berman on the Republican plan to make sure they never face that many voters again. Meanwhile, day three of impeachment. Day two highlighted the brutality of the Capitol attack. In Georgia, prosecutors launch a criminal investigation into Trump's election subversion. And a new report, the U.S. could have averted 40% of COVID deaths. That's just almost 200,000 people. Fed chair says real unemployment rate is at 10%, calls for fiscal stimulus. And dozens of former Republican officials have a Zoom call about a third party, and people actually covered it like it was a news story. Joe Biden talks with Xi Jinping, raises Taiwan and human rights. Lisa Cook, economist from the University of Michigan, in the running for the first black woman to be appointed to the Fed. Wisconsin Governor Evers trying to expand Medicaid again in the face of the Wisconsin Republican Party's opposition. Lastly, taxi workers shut down the Brooklyn Bridge. They need debt forgiveness on their medallion loans. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Emma is on vacation for a couple of days. Well deserved. My turn will come next week. In the meantime, we've got a lot to talk about today on the program. We just saw one of the most offensive clips that we can imagine here. So we're all a little bit distracted. We will get to that later in the program. It was a Fox News segment, of course. We probably should have said that. There's been a lot of stuff that's been rather disturbing out of Fox News. This one was particularly that that Dave Ramsey, who wants to convince you that there's nothing systemic about our society whatsoever, and that if you are suffering from debt or job loss or whatever it is all your fault. There's nothing systemic that happens in our society. It's just a coincidence who ends up having the money and who doesn't. And there's no such thing as luck. And you can ignore the fact that looking at an area code can tell you more than you need to know about someone's future financial situation than anything else. Zip code, I should say. We will get to that. I'm also not referring to the Tucker Carlson, where he was lying about George. We'll get to all that. But anyways, today, obviously, day three of the impeachment hearings. And I have to say, this impeachment hearing, I think, is has been revelatory to a lot of people. I am really sort of shocked at the, and I gauge this, I have friends, people in my life who are not as invested in politics as people who will watch this show on a regular basis. But they know that I am, obviously I do this professionally, and I get texts and messages, and I have gotten so many texts in the past couple of days from people who don't generally pay too much attention to politics, saying they are both amazed at how violent things were in the Capitol and amazed at how people are just coming to realize that. I mean, both those things, not from the same people, of course. The point being that, and we were just talking before the show, Brendan, one of our producers, had said that he's looking to maybe make some bets with some friends about who think that the Republicans will vote to convict. Now, if you don't follow politics too closely, you would be surprised that Republicans are not going to vote to convict. I think it's quite possible we get a couple more than one would have anticipated. But what that also indicates to me is that people who don't follow politics too closely think this is worthy of conviction. It suggests to me that people are following this impeachment trial more than one might imagine and are taking it quite seriously, and as well they should. It has been, I think, clearly established, right, that we know the Senate voted that Donald Trump can be held to account in an impeachment trial in the Senate, even though he's not president anymore. I think it's been quite clearly established that the rioters rioted. Now, the big question is, did Donald Trump incite this riot? And the evidence, I think, has been, fairly obvious to some of us, but I think it's going to be impossible for Republicans with a straight face to deny that's the case. Here's Joaquin Castro in the Senate impeachment hearing yesterday. He's one of the House managers. And just if there was any question as to what Donald Trump was tweeting out was in any way guiding what those insurrectionists were interested in, this sort of puts that to bed.
At 2:24 p.m., he tweeted, quote, "Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. USA demands the truth." Over an hour and a half into the attack, and this is what he tweeted. And he still, even at this point, did not acknowledge the attack on the Capitol, let alone condemn it. Instead, he further incites the mob against his own vice president, whose life was being threatened. Well, some of you may say, well, who was paying attention anyway? Well, that mob was paying attention.
Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. U.S. demands the truth.
The insurgents amplified President Trump's tweet attacking the vice president with a bullhorn. They were paying attention. And they also followed instructions. In fact, the insurgents were at one point, as you saw, 60 feet away from the vice president and the vice president's family.
Total coincidence. Total coincidence. No proof they're reading the tweet. They just came up with the same idea. That's just a total coincidence. Must mean it's true.
Great minds think alike.
I mean, if that's not enough, right there, I mean, obviously, people have seen the speech that he gave. But if that's not enough to establish that there was a relationship between what these rioters were doing and what Donald Trump was telling them, if it is in the minds of these Republican senators that that's just being superimposed upon and projected onto that dynamic just because they're Democrats saying it, how do you explain away this as reported by the Punch Bowl that House Leader McCarthy got into a heated exchange with Trump as he refused to grasp the severity of the Capitol attack? Here it is. House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy, as rioters were overrunning the Capitol building, engaged in a heated exchange with President Trump as he pushed them to denounce the attack, according to a source briefed on the back and forth. McCarthy, Trump's closest ally and confidant on Capitol Hill, was impressing upon Trump the real-time severity of the situation and implored him to forcefully denounce the attackers. Trump demurred. The point is here is that Kevin McCarthy thought that Donald Trump had the ability and the control over these people. That's why he called Trump. He wasn't calling Trump to say, come rescue me. Can you pull the car around? He wasn't saying to Trump, like, can you get in your jetpack and fly over here and get us out of here? He was saying, you have control over this insurrection, these rioters. And I'm asking you to exert that control in a way that's going to help us not get killed.
Yeah, notably, it wasn't going after the Democrats because it was Antifa coming in, right? He wasn't saying, Pelosi, call off Antifa. He was saying, Donald Trump, call off these MAGA people.
He was asking Trump to call off these people that Trump had sent in there. I mean, why call Trump if Trump has no control over these people? And maybe McCarthy was just good at explaining it to Trump, and that's why he didn't get that he should do that, because he didn't do it. I mean, so there you have a completely valid witness articulating that there was a relationship between these rioters and Donald Trump, that Donald Trump had control over these people. And then you also get insight into Donald Trump's mindset that he had no problem with what they were doing. And that's from Kevin McCarthy. And I got to imagine that there's other Republicans, they're sitting there and they know. They absolutely know. There really is the impressive part about this, and the scary part about this is we still don't know how far these Republican lawmakers would be willing to go down this road. We don't know. We haven't hit the limit. And so, you know, this concerted attempt and multi-pronged attempt by Donald Trump to reverse the election results, there is absolutely no reason to believe that if it wasn't closer, and if there wasn't a little bit more opportunity, that 45 at least of these Republican senators wouldn't have gone along with it. And these other five who are ostensibly primed to vote for his conviction, maybe they're doing this after he's out of power. But we don't know the outer limits of where these people would have, how far they would have gone. And I would suggest to you that there's every reason to believe it would have been pretty far. Speaking of which, when we come back in just a moment, Ari Berman will be here to tell us how Republicans are determined to not lose an election again because people are voting. Let's put it that way. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. In the meantime, one of our sponsors today, BetterHelp Online Counseling. You're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Look, very stressful time. I mean, personally, I'm in favor of therapy in all eras, but certainly during a pandemic when nerves are frayed and stress is through the roof, very helpful to see a therapist. And right now, I'm sure if people have bothered to try and look into it, therapists have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take weeks or months before they can see you. When you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You'll be talking to that therapist, one form or another, through your however device you decide, within 24 hours. Once BetterHelp connects you to a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, at any time, you can switch to a new one. And you can do so for free, and you don't need a reason, no additional charge. They make it easy for you to find someone who you are comfortable with. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. They have therapists with specialties that may not be available in your area, may be hard to find. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you would find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, help, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/majority report. We'll put the URL in the YouTube description. And also, of course, in the podcast description. Our other sponsor for today, Ground News. It is a first of its kind type of news comparison app. Lets you, and you can download the thing completely free. What it does is it aggregates news from different outlets across the ideological, I guess also international, I mean, across every spectrum you could imagine. Ideological, arguably financial, geographic. And it gives you a real clear notion of how different outlets report different stories. I mean, it's a great way to get your news, but it's also a great way to develop an ability to get a sense of what the built-in assumptions are in the way different media outlets report. And then you get a sense of like which ones over time you think are the most credible. You can compare Russian reporting to US reporting to UK reporting. You can compare how Breitbart covers a story versus the Washington Post. It also, obviously fills you in the blind spots you might have in the news landscape. Crucial stories that you may miss, you're not exposed to. We all live in our own social media bubbles, our own news bubbles. There's a great way to get you outside of those specific bubbles. Great way to learn really how to read the news. Great for teenagers, frankly. I'm trying to get my daughter to understand, like, you know, bias and this and that. This is one of the things I think I learned actually in comparative religious studies, was just depending on your discipline, you come in with certain assumptions. Well, the same thing is true with your ideology, where your geography, even who pays you, frankly. Whole point of Ground News is to make you more aware of these invisible agendas that news outlets are serving, so you can be a more neutral and thoughtful, mindfully informed consumer of information. Take control of how you consume news. Get the full story. Download the Ground News app totally free by going to ground.news/majority. You can find the link in the episode description. And lastly, I got an email from a listener who works for the state of Texas, and he wanted to let me know that the state of Texas, as well as possibly states, well, definitively your states, you just got to figure out how to find it, but it is called the Corona Relief Bill Rental Assistance Program. CR bra essentially, but you gotta really write it out to find it in your local area. Corona Relief Bill Rental Assistance. In Texas, it is TexasRentRelief.com. The site is up. You can't apply until the 15th, but it is how you will get funds for back rent up to 15 months, possibly, utilities, including past due utilities, and I believe 3 months of rent going forward. So check this out. We'll put a link to TexasRentRelief.com in our descriptions, and we will also just spell out Corona Relief Bill Rental Assistance. You can look in your state for that. In Texas, they're hoping to help out 70 to 80,000 households. So that's good news for those folks. All right. Want to welcome back to the program Ari Berman. He is a senior reporter at Mother Jones. He covers voting rights. He is the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. One of the most knowledgeable folks on voting rights in the country, and you can see he has his book just floating over his right shoulder. Ari, great to see you.
Hey, Sam. You know, it's all about product placement these days, as you know.
No, of course. Of course. You get to set up your own Zoom.
Just like you're in that Super Bowl-type set there with the logo behind you.
Exactly. Exactly. So, all right. Ari, I just want to set that, you know, often when we talk, the lodestar, if you will, is the ruling by the Supreme Court in 2013. I think it was 2013. And correct me if I'm wrong, to basically gut the Voting Rights Act by getting rid of the preclearance provision. And we saw, maybe it was 2011. I don't, you got to remind me of this, but it was within moments from that ruling, literally, you had Republican legislatures around the country changing their voting laws to essentially to disenfranchise voters in a way that they would have never been able to do if they had to ask the DOJ to permission to change their voting laws because they were under that preclearance provision. Despite all of that, and you categorize this, I mean, you cataloged this for years, we saw record turnout in this last election, and maybe in part because of COVID in some respects. Give me your sense of why that happened.
Sure. So let me just give you the chronology first. So the real war on voting that I've chronicled begins in 2011, when Republicans take back all of these key states in the 2010 election, and then in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Ohio, Florida, et cetera, they start passing new restrictions on voting. So that really lays the groundwork. Then in 2013, the Supreme Court weakens the Voting Rights Act and says that those states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. So that allows discriminatory laws that were blocked under the Voting Rights Act, like in Texas, to go through. And it also encourages states like North Carolina that had not yet passed these new restrictions to put them through. So those are kind of the two pivotal moments, what happened after 2010, and then what happened after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013. But I think in 2020, we saw a tremendous amount of organizing against voter suppression. We saw a tremendous amount of organizing to get people to vote, more than I had ever seen before. And because of COVID, in most states, people had three different ways to vote. They could vote by mail, they could vote early in person, or they could vote on election day in person. And a lot of states didn't have all three of those options. A lot of states didn't have, for example, large amounts of mail voting, or they hadn't used early voting in big numbers before. So the fact that people had so many different ways to vote, and there was so much education mobilization going in to make sure that people actually did vote and their votes actually were counted, I think that's what led to record turnout in this election. Of course, that's what terrifies Republicans, because the whole purpose of these laws was to try to prevent this kind of turnout. And the fact that we saw that turnout, that Joe Biden won, that Democrats retook the Senate, has now led them to engage in a new effort to restrict voting rights that is very similar to what they engaged in after 2011, but in my view, even worse.
There's sort of like a quality of Well, in part an arms race, right? Because every time they come up with a new innovation to suppress votes, there is, or at least there was in this last cycle, a real strong pushback. And I think in part, you know, my sense is like, you know, the way that the Republicans in Wisconsin tried to diminish the vote in that primary vote where they insisted on it's completely safe to come and vote. And meanwhile, the guy's in a hazmat suit. And like, I think that really inspired people to get out there and figure out how we're going to vote in a way that we hadn't seen before. I also wonder if when we look at these voter ID laws from, you know, now 10 years, they've been, a lot of these have been instituted. Are we seeing, because younger, you know, we're just seeing a younger cohort, like there was a lot of older voters, particularly black voters, who could get disenfranchised by not having an ID because they're older, or, you know, a lot of times, like, they don't have the same state records. I mean, is there a generational shift, and there's because we've caught up with it, is that a less effective way of suppressing the vote than it was 10 years ago?
That's a good question. I mean, I think to your earlier point, Wisconsin was a major clarifying moment, the primary in April. The fact that Wisconsin was the only state that did not delay their primary because of COVID and basically thought, listen, COVID's going to keep all of these Democrats from the polls, so that we're going to win this crucial state Supreme Court election, which is going to give us a 5-2 majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court so we can do whatever we want for the next decade. Democrats saw that. They heard that and they said, we are not going to let this happen. But it was also a template for future states to realize that this is the lengths that Republicans are going to go to try to suppress the vote. Everyone's going to see it this time. It's not going to happen, you know, under the rug like it happens in the past. Everyone's at home watching TV. Everyone is going to see these images. Everyone's going to understand what is happening here. And that led to the largest voter mobilization, largest voter education effort, I think, it probably in American history, to really tell people step by step, this is how you're going to be able to vote in a pandemic. And there was more emphasis, not only in preparing people to vote, but making sure that their votes were actually counted than I had ever seen before. And I think, you know, when you have a law that's in place for a decade, people can start to figure out how to organize around it. So yeah, the voter ID laws are always going to be most burdensome the first time they're introduced. So it's going to have the biggest impact. For example, in Wisconsin in 2016, it had a much bigger impact than in 2020 because people weren't used to it and they didn't know what to do to get the ID. And there, it was harder for them to organize around it. That said, there are always people that slip through the cracks. When we talk about the record turnout, 66% turnout, I think is what it was in 2020. That still means that a third of the country didn't vote. And there may be a lot of different reasons why they didn't vote, but for a certain percentage of people, they didn't vote because they didn't have the right documentation. They didn't have the right idea. They didn't understand the rules and thought they weren't going to be able to participate, or they actually couldn't participate. That includes, for example, like 770,000 people in Florida that should have gotten the right to vote back because they passed an initiative saying that people with past felony convictions could vote. Then the Florida legislature said, you can't vote if you owe past fines, fees, or restitution. So, I mean, Florida disenfranchised 700,000 people in the last election. That's a huge segment of people that were not able to participate in one of the most important swing states in the country. And we kind of all forgot about that after the election. And we talked about how Joe Biden underperformed with Latinos, which obviously was part of the story. But we didn't talk about how 700,000 people just couldn't vote in the first place.
Right. And one of the elements, 2 points, one that I've learned from you in the past, is that sometimes it's not even the actual provisions. It's the confusion around the provisions that it just, acts as what they call like a kludge, you know. And so it's like, it just provides a mental obstacle to voting. And people are just so confused by the whole thing. They're just like, I don't want to get caught into that. I also say, in terms of that Wisconsin primary, a lot of folks I know in Wisconsin who work in this area, they were very thankful that Bernie Sanders maintained his staying in that primary race for Wisconsin, because they knew that would drive turnout. And that really important in terms of winning those, particularly that Supreme Court race that was there. So let me ask you this before we get into the specifics of what you've been working on in terms of reporting the reaction to the 2020 race. To what extent down the road, if we're going to see any type of further cases involving voting rights, to what extent will all that we saw during COVID, the increase in mail-in balloting, the increase in early voting, to what extent does this establish evidence that A, these things function to increase turnout, and B, they can be done without any significant threat to our election security, right? I mean, we had 80 cases that established there doesn't seem to be any election fraud here. I mean, to what extent does this become sort of like facts on the ground? Like, I mean, if I'm going to argue a case and say, we know mail-in balloting increases turnout by X percentage, that means if you get rid of it, it's going to reduce voting by X percentage. And there is no compelling reason to do so because we know it can be done without fraud.
Well, we had two really compelling data points in 2020, which is that we gave people the most options to vote than they ever had before. And we had the highest turnout since 1900. And not only that, but it was also judged to be the most secure election in history. So there was no trade-off between access and security. We had the most access we'd seen in 100 years, and we had the most security we had seen ever. And so when Republican states start taking away things like mail voting, there's going to be a very strong record to say this increased turnout. It increased turnout specifically among these groups. And there was no fraud. So there's no reason to get rid of it. And so this is going to be a really interesting experiment. It's not going to be a theoretical experiment because the Brennan Center for Justice released a new report. They found that 165 new voting restrictions have been introduced in 33 states so far already this year. I mean, legislators just got back in session and they're already doing this.
I just want to clarify, like over the past 30 some days. Wow.
In the past month, basically, 165 new voting restrictions have been introduced in 33 states, and half of them target mail voting. So mail voting is in many ways the new voter ID because Republicans blame it for losing, even though mail voting was something that was pushed by Republicans for many, many years, was used more by Republicans in states like Georgia and Arizona until 2020. And if you think about who the Republican electorate is, they are older and more rural. So they need mail voting more than younger urban Democrats that can get to the polls much easier in places like Atlanta. And so I think this a whole attack on mail voting by Republicans is incredibly short-sighted. Just because Democrats used it more in 2020 because they took COVID more seriously doesn't mean that Republicans aren't going to use it more in 2022 or 2024 when Donald Trump is not demonizing it. And in fact, state-level Republicans were begging their voters to vote by mail. That's why you saw all of these mailers sent by Republicans in Florida and Georgia and Arizona and all these other states saying, please vote by mail. They had automatic lists of people that got mail ballots. So it was the easiest way for them to vote. It wasn't like you didn't even have to show up at your polling place. You got a ballot automatically mailed to you if you had voted by mail in the past. And the only reason they didn't use it is because Trump told them not to.
So why are they, and I want to get into the specifics of the states that you look at, which all coincidentally were, you know, sort of the states that came down to that basically the race came down to in 2020. But why, if it is the case, I mean, if you can do that calculation, right, that like 2022, 2024, we're probably going to revert back to, you know, sort of like traditional patterns, or we could anyways. And if we do, this foreclosure of mail-in balloting is going to inhibit the Republican vote tally more. Why are they doing this?
Well, they're doing it because they're looking at the numbers in 2020 and they're seeing that more Democrats use mail voting than Republicans use mail voting. And they're only looking at the data from 2020. They're not looking at the data from any past elections, because the past elections would show them mail voting was split between the parties or even used more by Republicans. So they're only looking at the last election. They're thinking that Democrats are going to use mail voting to increase voter turnout in future elections, that there's a model now in Georgia, for example. Stacey Abrams used mail voting a lot in 2018 to increase turnout among Black voters, particularly rural Black voters that don't get a lot of attention, and that Democrats use that again very effectively in 2020. You know what? Republicans could do the same thing. If Republicans actually spent their time trying to turn out voters instead of suppress Democratic voters, they could use mail voting as effectively, if not more effectively, than Democrats, but they're looking at it very short-sightedly. And they're thinking, well, if Democrats are going to use mail voting more than we are in 2022 and 2024, then we need to get rid of it or make it harder, even though there's no reason why Republicans can't use it again in 2022 and 2024.
Let me offer a counterpoint just from the lessons I think we learned in the last sort of the end of Reconstruction and the new Jim Crow era, or I should say the old Jim Crow era. And that is, to the extent that, particularly when we're talking about southern states, to the extent that we saw the rollout of programs to disenfranchise people voting, they weren't so happy about poor folk in general, not just African-Americans not voting, but also just poor whites. And they were happy to disenfranchise both Black people and poor white people because, they thought that they may not be able to get so many votes from there, too. And so I'm not convinced that part of that is just like, you know what? We can shape this electorate. We can get rid of a significant portion of the African-American vote. And then we can also shape this electorate so that to the extent that it's, we're making the electorate more white again, we can also maybe make it a little bit more wealthy, which might help them. I don't know.
Yeah, except now, wealthier whites are voting more Democratic in suburban Atlanta than poor whites in rural Georgia, although it tends to vary depending on where you're talking about. I think they feel like they're okay with some collateral damage as long as it hurts Democrats more. So I think that's the general feeling. I mean, you look at Georgia, for example. They're talking about getting rid of automatic voter registration, where you automatically are registered when you get a driver's license at the DMV. 5 million of 7 million voters in Georgia registered that way. So you're talking about taking away a form of registration that 5 million people use. They're talking about getting rid of mail voting. So you need an excuse now to vote absentee. That would get rid of something that was used by 1.3 million voters in 2020. So, I mean, this is going to hurt a lot of Republicans too. They're talking about getting rid of forms of voting that millions and millions of people use in the last election. These are not minor tweaks to the electoral process. These are radical changes in terms of how the election worked. And they're just betting that it's going to hurt more Democrats than Republicans. And it's hard to say that they're wrong if you look at the data from 2020. But I think it's a very short-sighted political argument because Republicans also benefited from high turnout in 2020. That's what doesn't get talked about a lot. They did very well in the House of Representatives. They did very well in state legislative races. They brought a lot of infrequent voters who like Trump but don't really like the Republican Party out to the polls. Those people could also be disenfranchised if you make it more difficult to vote. Because if they're not that inclined to vote in general, then you make it more difficult and you see what happens. It's kind of like the vaccination process right now. How many more people are going to get vaccinated? We can go to every pharmacy and do it, compared to having to jump through a million hoops and call 20 different doctors to try to figure out if a vaccine's available. That's what they want to do with voting in Georgia. They don't want to make it that you can vote easily. They want to make it that you have to jump through all these hoops, and inevitably, that's going to decrease participation.
Yeah, that is a story that gets lost. Both in 2018 and in 2020, the Republicans saw a record turnout as well. It just so happened that the Democratic record turnout was bigger. I wonder if they're thinking that they're going to lose those Trump voters. They're going to stay at home because there's no Donald Trump and maybe they're not going to come out. I don't know. They were out in 2018 and Donald Trump wasn't on the ballot. All right. Well, let's talk about a little bit more about Georgia. I did not know this about that Hancock County had been subject to had basically been an opt-in or a drop-in. I can't remember the term where they are now part of preclearance because of their voting, disenfranchisement attempts. But tell us more about what Georgia's doing.
So I told this story in a recent piece of mine, which is there's a rural county in Georgia called Hancock County. It's about 100 miles southeast of Atlanta. And there was a mayoral election in the county seat of Sparta, which has about 1,000 people, and it's 90% Black. Now, through a weird series of circumstances, the Board of Elections in Hancock County, which is a majority Black county, was majority white. And white members of the Board of Elections tried to remove Black voters from the rolls in advance of this mayoral election. And they tried to challenge the registrations of 20% of Black voters in this county seat of Sparta. And they sent police to serve them summons, saying they had to appear at the Board of Elections hearing or they would be removed from the rolls, which is a very, very intimidating tactic. And what happened was that a lot of people were removed from the rolls in this majority Black county, in this majority Black city. A white mayor was elected for the first time in 32 years in the town of Sparta, and voter participation declined by 40%. Now, the reason I told this story in my new article was that the county attorney for Hancock County, who defended this voter purge, is a guy by the name of Barry Fleming. He's a state representative. He is now chair of a special committee on election integrity in Georgia that the Speaker of the House set up to put in place all of this restrictive registration. So the guy that was in charge of purging Black voters in Georgia is now going to be the guy in charge of quote unquote election integrity in the state. And that's the kind of thing we're dealing with here. And the proposals that Georgia is talking about, we'll see what actually passes, but the proposals they're talking about, getting rid of automatic registration, getting rid of no excuse absentee voting, getting rid of ballot drop boxes, getting rid of the ability of third party groups to send voter registration materials, preventing people who move to the state in November from voting in a runoff in January, which makes absolutely no sense because they're residents of the state. These are huge changes to the process at a time when Georgia had record turnout in 2020 and, of course, flipped for Joe Biden for the first time they voted for a Democrat in 30 years and elected two Democrats to the Senate, one Black, one Jewish. First Black member of the Senate from Georgia, first Jewish member to the Senate in Georgia at a time when Black turnout was higher than it had ever been before. So this with and an election, which the Secretary of State, the Republican Secretary of State, said over and over and over to Donald Trump, there was zero evidence of fraud. They had three recounts in Georgia, and they had zero evidence of fraud. So, I mean, it's really the best test case for what happened in 2020. There was record voter turnout. There was no problems, unlike past elections in Georgia. And then the minute that happens, the first thing Republicans do is turn around and say, we're going to target all the methods that led to this record turnout.
Let's move, because Georgia obviously is not the only place where Republicans are doing this. Arizona. That Republican state legislatures.
Arizona's crazy. I mean, of course, remember, this is a state that just censured Cindy McCain, just censured the Republican governor of the state. So it's a crazy time there. The Arizona legislature has introduced 34 bills to make it harder to vote, which is such an crazy number to introduce so far. And it runs the whole gamut. They're talking, like in Georgia, they're talking about getting...
I don't mean to interrupt you. How many bills could they have introduced, period, since that time? Like, I mean, this is the thing that I think I feel like Republicans understand in a way that Democrats never seem to understand. Their job number one when they get into office... I mean, if they have introduced that many bills, and maybe it's possible that's only a fraction of the bills. Maybe they've introduced 1,000 bills. I don't think so. But they get in and their job number one is, what can we change legislatively to enhance our ability to maintain our power? Period. End of story. The idea that there is a broad constituency out there for, like, when you guys get in office, I want to make sure that you guys are making sure that the electorate is 7/10 the size that it is now. You know, like no, that they do this. It's amazing to me.
Yeah. I mean, when Republicans get in power, the first thing they think about is, how can we abuse power to prevent the other party from ever getting in power? And when Democrats take power, they just make all of these excuses why they can't exercise the power that they actually have. And so I mean, it really, what's happening, what Democrats are doing in the U.S. Senate by refusing to get rid of the filibuster, and what Republicans are doing in states like Georgia and Arizona, cannot be any starker in terms of how they view that the power they have. But so the kind of things they're doing in Georgia, they're trying to get rid of mail voting. They're trying to eliminate this list or purge hundreds of thousands of voters from a list of who automatically receives mail ballots. Arizona is a state where 80% of people vote by mail. So 3.2 million voters are on a list of people that get absentee ballots every single election. And they want to get rid of that list or pare it back significantly. The craziest proposal, there's two other proposals. So they have all these laws that target mail voting. Then they have a law that says you can only have a certain number of polling places. So at the same time, they're trying to get rid of mail voting. They're also basically saying we're going to make it really hard to vote in person too. So under one proposal, Maricopa County, the largest county in the state, which flipped for Joe Biden, they, instead of being able to have 100 polling places, would only be able to have 15 polling places under one of these proposals, which is just totally crazy. The most insane proposal in Arizona or in any other state, though, is a bill that would basically say the legislature can appoint its own presidential electors anytime it wants, no matter how people vote. So like Arizona votes for Biden, like forget it. We don't care. We're just going to appoint our own electors and there's nothing you can do about it. This is exactly what Trump wanted them to do in 2020. And they didn't do it because they didn't have the power to do it. And now they're basically saying the election's meaningless in the state because we can do whatever we want to overturn it. And so I don't think that's going to pass because I think that's just way too crazy. But the fact that it's even on the table is really chilling. And I think the strategy here is just flood the zone with as many crazy ideas as possible. So then you fight the craziest ideas, but then the ones that are slightly less crazy, that's the compromise that is allowed to go through. And that's what I'm concerned about here, is not that everything's going to pass, although it could because Republicans are in control of Arizona, just like they're in control of state government in Georgia. It's that there's going to be so many moving targets. It's going to be really, really difficult to defeat all of them.
Pennsylvania, we have another similar dynamic.
Similar dynamic, a little bit different. They've introduced, as of a week ago, 14 bills to make it harder to vote. They want to do things like get rid of no-excuse absentee voting, which all but two Republicans voted for. They want to get rid of ballot drop boxes. They want to make sure that your ballot has to arrive by Election Day, not a few days after, even though that's written into the Pennsylvania law. A lot of this stuff's not going to pass immediately because they have a Democratic governor that can veto it. What I'm concerned about in Pennsylvania is there might not be a Democratic governor after 2022 because Tom Wolf is term limited. So if a Republican gets in there, they can pass this stuff in time for 2024. There's also this proposal to try to gerrymander the state courts. You might remember it was the Pennsylvania state courts that struck down extreme gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. It was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that refused to pass all these restrictions on mail voting that Republicans wanted. So now they're saying, we want to redraw the courts. This is, again, one of the craziest proposals I've seen. They want to gerrymander the courts that struck down gerrymandering. And what they want to do is, instead of elections being statewide, so people can run from anywhere in Pennsylvania, they want to draw districts for every state Supreme Court justice, for example, so that they can gerrymander the district so that instead of a Democratic progressive majority on the Supreme Court, there will be a gerrymandered Republican Supreme Court. Then of course, would be hearing challenges to voter suppression and gerrymandering that would be passed by these legislators.
And we need to make something really clear here. The role of a state Supreme Court justice, or frankly, any judge, is not to be representative of a specific group of people. I mean, it's one thing to have these judges elected by the entire state, but there is absolutely no rationale to have a regional election for these people unless you wanted to fashion that region in such a way that it will always elect a specific type of person to this court. I mean,
of course,
no logic to that whatsoever. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say we need to have state legislature from, you know, my town because we have specific interests about what has to happen in, you know, in any given place. But there's no logic whatsoever to have Supreme Court justices come from a certain part of the state. That's just absurd, we should say. And we should also say this state Supreme Court struck down the gerrymandering that took place in the congressional districts, but not in the state legislature districts. So you still have that dynamic where in Pennsylvania, more Democrats come out to vote for their state legislative lawmakers, but more Republicans win. That you all have in, let's say, Wisconsin.
Exactly. And that's why a decade after they drew the maps in 2011 in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan and all of these states, Republicans are still in control of the legislature. And I just find it really surprising that Wisconsin would vote for Joe Biden. They would vote to have a Democratic governor. Same with Michigan, same with Pennsylvania. But they're so happy with their Republican legislature, they would leave them in power for an entire decade. It would be the only position in the state to which they would say, we like the Republicans so much, let's keep them in control. The only reason they're still there is because of gerrymandering. It's the only reason they're still in control in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania is because they drew the districts in 2011. It worked perfectly. They're still in power. Now they're going to draw them all over again, although it's going to be a little bit different in those states because there's either Democratic governors or in Michigan, there's going to be an independent redistricting commission. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in Michigan, for example, when there are actually fair districts drawn, how the state votes.
Well, I can tell you what's going to happen. It's going to end up going to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court's going to say the state legislature cannot delegate that authority to an independent commission. We're just going to allow the Republicans to redraw the districts. That's my guess anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that would be very ironic because when the Supreme Court said that federal courts can't review partisan gerrymandering in 2018, they expressly said there are other solutions like independent redistricting commission. So it would be Mitch McConnell-esque cynical, which I'm not putting past this current Supreme Court, to say it's kind of like how Mitch McConnell said, let's delay impeachment until after Trump's gone, and then we can't impeach him because he's no longer in office. I mean, that is essentially what they'd be doing with independent redistricting commissions if they took that line.
Okay, I got two questions for you to wrap this up. One, I think people heard the story of, and this played out in the Supreme Court census case, but there was a story about a daughter whose dad died, who was a big Republican operative. She found his computer hard drive as she was going through his stuff. They were a little estranged. They had different political philosophies. She found that this guy had written out for the Department of Justice, essentially their alibi, to lie about why they need to not have immigrants counted on the census. And this played a big part in that census case. He was also known as like the godfather of Republican sort of gerrymandering and sort of vote suppression strategy down to the very granular demographic level. So you guys are going to be able to eliminate Latino voters here. Are you going to be able to eliminate that? How much has his passing away, has that affected anything, or was, you know, basically his expertise absorbed into the Republican Borg?
Yeah, I think that's right. Tom Hoffler is his name, and he's passed away. But yeah, I mean, I think there's other people in the Republican Party that know how to gerrymander. And there was just a report out from the Brennan Center for Justice today that I'd urge people to look at, because they're basically saying all of the population growth in states like Texas and Florida and Georgia and North Carolina is coming from people of color. 4 out of 5 new eligible voters are people of color. But Republicans are going to try to draw these maps to maintain white power in the face of these massive demographic changes. And I believe that's the story of American politics right now, writ large, what the Republican Party is doing as the country becomes more diverse. And I think that's why there was a Capitol insurrection in the first place. But I think it's going to be played out at the most granular level in redistricting, because they're going to say, how can we weaken the power of all of these communities that should actually have more power, because they are the future of the country, but instead we're going to give them less power. And so I think that's going to be something to keep an eye on. And I don't think they need Tom Hoffa around to be able to do it. They have other people that can draw these maps. But it's going to be really, really interesting to see what we learn about this process, because they're going to be pursuing the exact same strategy that he pursued. The question is, are we going to be able to do anything about it? And are the courts going to be able to do anything about it? And I think I'm very, very concerned that the 6-3 Supreme Court is going to have either no problems with this or just say we shouldn't get involved at all.
Right. I have a feeling that it's going to be the latter, because when things are going their way, they stand back. All right. So lastly, you brought up this point earlier. Republicans get into office. The first thing they do is they try and disenfranchise voters that they think aren't going to vote for them. Democrats get into office. They get power. They look at the filibuster. Now, you said like they should get rid of the filibuster, but it's not just for the sake of getting rid of the filibuster, although I think we would both agree that that would make things more democratic, small d. Like, you could actually have the party that wins the most votes make the laws. And so us as a voter can determine, like, hey, I really don't like it when they get in power because this is what they do, as opposed to sort of say, like, oh, we would do this, but we can't because of them. But the real issue here is, when the Democrats took control of the House, they passed H.R. 1. Among other things in this about corruption, it was about restoring the Voting Rights Act. It was about increasing the federal right to vote so that it would be harder for states to do these type of things that you've been talking about and you've been reporting on for years. Do you think, have you heard in the course of your reporting, when they... that there is going to be an attempt, obviously, to pass, I think they call it the John Lewis Act at this point. Is that going to be the moment that they use to try and get rid of the filibuster? I mean, give me your sense of how this is going to play out, because that has to happen.
Yeah, I mean, so Democrats have two incredibly important pieces of legislation that could literally save American democracy. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act to restore the Voting Rights Act, and H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which is the most sweeping democracy reform bill in a generation, and would address all of the things that we are talking about by mandating early voting and automatic registration and independent redistricting and voting rights for people with past felony convictions. I mean, every good thing on voting is in that bill. And the only way they're going to pass them is by eliminating the filibuster or creating an exception to the filibuster for laws that pertain to voting and democracy, because there's no way these bills are going to get 60 Republican votes. Lisa Murkowski is the only Republican that signed on to the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and not a single Republican has signed on to H.R. 1 or S1, as it's known in the Senate. So, I mean, this is going to be a real thing here. And I think the strategy for the Democrats is, let's let the Republicans filibuster this, and people are going to get so angry that they are going to say, we can't allow this to happen again. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen. That's a risky strategy. I would like there to be more of a strategy going into it to try to figure out what you do. The key people, obviously, are Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. I think Joe Manchin's a tough nut to crack because he's a Democrat from West Virginia. Kyrsten Sinema is a senator from Arizona in a state where they've introduced 34 new voter suppression laws. So I do not think it should be a tough argument for her to say, listen, you want to survive, you want the Democratic Party to survive, you want Mark Kelly to survive, the Republican legislature in Arizona is going to do everything they can to prevent you from winning your next election unless we pass the For the People Act and unless we pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. I think you could make that argument to Joe Manchin too, but I think Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, one of those states that targeted by voter suppression, that should at least be an easier argument for her. And then it's just down to Manchin. And then the question is, you're a Democrat. Do you want the Democratic Party to survive as a political institution? Or do you want Republicans to be able to entrench power through anti-democratic means for the next decade and beyond? So you're never in the majority. And that's basically the end of it. I mean, so I don't know if that's going to work on Joe Manchin. I don't know what he really cares about. But this is not just about, I mean, it's about two things. It's about small d democracy and whether it survives, but it's also about whether the Democratic Party is going to be able to have power beyond 2 years. And I think it's going to be very, very hard for them to keep power in the House or the Senate if all of these anti-democratic measures that we're talking about go through and the Democrats have no federal response.
I got to say, Joe Manchin is an interesting character in all of this, because he seems to posture in certain ways and then ends up voting. You know, I think we'll get a sense of this on the $15 minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. But he tends to end up where he lands is really the thing where you get to watch. He likes to do a lot of like loop-de-loops before he gets there. But he generally lands, I think. Well, I guess we'll see. But it would be interesting. Interesting legacy for Joe Manchin to be the vote that gets a sweeping voting reform into law. Ari Berman, always fascinating stuff. We will link to your piece at Mother Jones and, of course, to your book if people want to understand the fight that was involved in voting rights. Thank you so much for your time. They really appreciate
it. Good to talk to you again, Sam. Thanks a lot.
All right, we're going to do a quick break. We'll be right back. Finish this up. So, just finishing up, the impeachment trial has resumed in the Senate, and we were talking at the beginning of the show how it was quite clear, and Joaquin Castro did a great job of showing essentially Donald Trump's tweets, and then who and the impact that had on the insurrectionists who were crashing the Capitol. Here is a good sign that the Republicans are a little bit concerned that this is just all too clear and to the American public and capturing their attention. Fox and Friends, always my barometer for how the Republicans are going to spin something on any given day, and particularly Brian Kilmeade, because it feels like that Ducey has just sort of checked out a little bit. I think he sort of farmed out being the shill to his son. But here is Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends this morning.
A lot of video. Day one was full of video, almost like the cold open to a Rachel Maddow show. And then this, some of the surveillance video we had not seen yet. No doubt about it. Pence, Pelosi, and Romney were in danger. No doubt about it. It was really bad. It was a pleasure, though, to hear cops, police officers being praised for a change from Democrats. We haven't heard that in about 2 years, and they should be praised every day, and especially the way they acted here. They never should have the January 6th rally. Does anyone disagree with that? If President Trump wanted to show his popularity, win Georgia, at least one of the seats. That would have actually shown more. It got out of control. I don't think he ever intended that, and that's the point. Was President Trump having a rally get them fired up? Did he ever intend for them to breach the building and threaten to kill his vice president, the most loyal person he had, Mitt Romney, who he's had disagreement from his party? And they were looking for some of the more high-profile lawmakers, no doubt about it. But it became very redundant, too. It was like the same thing, the same person showing more emotion, deciding something personal about them. And that's when I think they're beginning to lose the public. As we get set for day three, they're going to finish up with some more testimony. Right. And then we got more of this. And then we're going to see what the Trump team has.
Yeah, my sense is that if the Kilmeade thought they were losing the public, then he wouldn't be suggesting that they're losing the public in the same way. He would be he wouldn't be defending and making excuses for Donald Trump. But if your argument is that his interest was never to let it get out of control and have them do that, then you need to answer the question, why is he holding a rally on January 6th, at the moment before they're certifying the election? Like, if it wasn't to impact that act taking place in the Capitol, what was it for? What was the point of it? Brian Kilmeade does not have an answer for that, because if he were to answer it, he would know it was to intimidate by any means necessary. You got to fight hard. This is special. Special fight when it's being stolen, he said.
Otherwise, you're a coward.
Otherwise, you're a coward. Got to do it right. Got to fight in a different way, if you know what I mean. We will know more about this impeachment. I think that the Republicans are getting a little worried. They're going to lose a couple of those votes in the Senate. We will discuss this and more tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around today, we will head into the fun half, but I won't be with you because, as is the tradition around here, Thursdays, the crew comes in. Emma, of course, on vacation. But old Matt will be with us. Let me just remind you, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, we have information for you. If you are in need of any type of rent assistance or utility assistance over the past year, check out. We have at least the URL for the Texas one, and also the name of the program that you should be Googling in your state. If we, you know, I imagine people will be listening to this and they will send in more, and we will let you know over the next couple of days as they come in. We're going to be on vacation next. Well, no, I'm going to be, but Emma won't be. So Emma will be able to tell folks about it too. We've never done this before. Never. I'm a little bit nervous because I've never been on vacation and the show's actually continuing. I mean, I've been gone for a day or two, but not 4 days. It's a little nerve-wracking. But just a reminder, that's crazy, though, over the course of 10 years, right? JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Don't forget, AM Quickie. Find it at amquickie.com. And JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. At this point, they've gotten so much love from people on Twitter because Glenn Greenwald had attacked me for shilling for this co-op, that I think that they're close to making like a Glenn Greenwald blend.
Yeah, don't let Glenn find about Hello Tushy.
Yeah, now that is going to be a real problem. That's probably my greatest liability is the Hello Tushy stuff. Although I got to tell you, I don't know, Matt, you may not have bought into that, but believe me, it's a revelation. Do we have old Matt? Is old Matt here? There he is.
Hello, Sam.
Folks, don't forget to check out Nomi's show today. You can find it at youtube.com/ the Nomiki show and the Nomiki show. And somebody, I get so many emails, I can't even tell you. And so many different people tell me they do it different ways, but I think I need to do it as two syllables. Nomiki show, twitch.tv/the_Nomiki_show. Old Matt, what's happening on Doomed?
On Doomed, we're gonna push back Doomed. It usually is on a Thursday night. We're gonna push it back just a few days. Follow me on Twitter at Matt Binder. And on YouTube, youtube.com/MattBinder, because I want to fully cover the whole, everything that happens in this impeachment trial, because it's getting kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, actually. It really is. It's getting a little bit more intense than I think I had even anticipated, frankly. So,
right. So, you know, if you had a daily show, I get covering the everyday stuff and then just updating it the next day. But if you do a weekly show like me, if I do a show tonight, it's going to be outdated by tomorrow. So I'm going to wait a few days. I'm going to get all that information. We're going to have a full blown show about the second impeachment of Donald Trump over the weekend. Follow me at Matt Binder on Twitter, youtube.com/MattBinder, and you will be updated to know exactly when that is. And also, I'll have another video for those of you who like the Boogaloo Boy video that I put out. This one's not about Boogaloo Boys or Jimmy Dore, but if you like that video, I have another video like that coming out in the coming week as well.
Oh!
Jamie, back from your skiing. Where were you? You going in Utah? There was reports that you couldn't leave the state because you were quarantined. What's going on?
Yeah, so I went skiing in Utah with my friend and his family, and I followed all the rules. Don't worry, which for going to Utah was no rules. But for coming back from Utah, I had to get a COVID test, and now I got to quarantine myself in my apartment for a little while and then get another COVID test. It was kind of annoying because you had to enter a Utah address in order to get tested in Utah, which seems like a bit of a catch-22. But the people at the drive-through testing facility were very helpful. They helped us fudge it, as I'm sure they do many times a day, and I am COVID-free as far as I know.
Okay, well... admitted to a civil misdemeanor, maybe.
Yeah, Cuomo's going to hunt you down for that.
Oh, boy. Well, federalism means that they do not talk to each other. So I think it's fine. Also, I managed to screw up my neck a little bit. So I have now the chance to try out this wonderful CBD salve that they keep sending me.
There you go.
I wouldn't worry about the state. You know, Cuomo is already reopening the restaurants, reopening MSG and Barclays Center. Obviously, he's given up and doesn't care anymore.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, he wrote the book. That's how I look at it. He wrote the book. He's got a safe face. He can't admit it's getting worse because he wrote the book. He's successful. He did it. He got rid of it. To admit otherwise, he'd be going back on everything he wrote in print forever in that book.
I'm just
sitting around his office going like, maybe we should have just waited before we put the book out.
Right. I'm just
I wish, but that would take him like having some sort of introspection and knowing that he did something that he shouldn't have. But Cuomo doesn't seem like the type.
Like, what do we have to do to keep this guy from taking the credit? Just like Giuliani happened to be, you know, the mayor on 9/11 and he somehow got credit for that. I feel like it's going to be the same thing with Cuomo, no matter how badly he messed it up.
Cuomo will have to just befriend and then eventually defend the next Donald Trump, pretty much. That's what he would need for liberals to decide that Cuomo is not the hero that they think he is.
I think he's got a little bit of tarnish. I don't think it's not 6 to 8 months ago. That's my sense anyways. I mean, the idea though, like, I understand the pressures to open up, and, you know, because obviously, like, they don't want to do anything to provide relief to people who are working in these places. But you can't wait 6 weeks. Like, it's going to be, you know, like, we're going to get, like, it's going to be, you're going to be able to do, like, legit outdoor dining again in 6 weeks. Like, you can't wait. It's just insanity to me, but.
Valentine's Day is coming up, Sam. What do you expect all these couples to do?
Yes, gets COVID together, stays together. New Matt, what is happening on the Matt Lekian media platform? Wait, did you, Jamie? Jamie?
No, I did not. Okay. Whoops. So this week on the Antifada, we had on Kay Gabriel, who is my comrade from the DSA Emerge Caucus, and she's also very active in the Defund the NYPD campaign. And she kind of gave a bit of a counterpoint to some of our more, shall we say, ultra-left, anti-state communist guests who have been very critical of campaigns to defund the police because they believe that it points in a non-revolutionary direction. So we try to be fair and balanced at the Antifada and hear out all viewpoints from, you know, anti-state communists to other kinds of communists. So I think it was a really good back and forth. And
they report, you decide.
Yeah, exactly. So that's up now. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, we're doing a special Twitch stream at an earlier time at 6 p.m. Tomorrow, Friday, instead of the usual time, 7. So everyone tune in at 6 p.m. Eastern, twitch.tv/TheAntifada for me and Sean, and we'll have a lot of fun.
Matt!
Ben Bird just joining Left Reckoning tonight at 8 Eastern at the Left Reckoning YouTube channel. We're going to be talking about Haiti, Ecuador, liberal succession. So blue states are going to secede, so we'll talk about that a little bit, and the future of oil. So that's tonight. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to access the post game.
All right, folks. I'll be back tomorrow. You will be in good hands. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 238.
56, 27. One half, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.